This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski.
Ultimately, my worry is, and what's going to be my guiding principle over the next week as I enter into these deliberations, is will a U.S. attack make the situation better for the Syrian people or worse?
That's Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy on Meet the Press Sunday. It was sort of a whirlwind couple of days for the junior senator, speaking out against possible military intervention in Syria. Now, yesterday, Murphy held a press conference just before going back to D.C. for a hearing with Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and Secretary of State John Kerry.
I return to Washington still as a skeptic of military intervention in Syria.
During this hearing, he showed his skepticism further in this exchange with Kerry.
But that's I don't think that's the dispute. The dispute is not that there's a correlation between intelligence.
The dispute is, what are you going to do about it?
The military to be able to influence the reality on the ground.
The dispute is, what are you prepared to do about it? That's the dispute.
Yeah, so today, Where We Live, our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, we're going to go from this global dispute over intervention in Syria to the most local thing we can cover, town government. Next Tuesday is primary day for municipal elections, and there are fascinating races in places ranging from the Havens to the Rose of New England. But first, Syria. You can join us, 860-275-7266. What do you think about the president's plan for military intervention in that civil war? What do you think of our delegation's reaction? You can call us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Email us wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. Coming up in a moment, we'll be hearing from two people who are very close to this, but I want to welcome in our guests in studio, Colin McEnroe, a regular here on The Wheelhouse, and the host of WNPR's The Colin McEnroe Show. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankowski.
And Matt Dorenzo is here. He's group editor for the 21st Century Media Company, which we'll be naming off all the newspapers that Matt works with in just a few minutes. It'll take about 10 minutes to do that. Matt, good to see you once again.
Good morning.
First of all, Colin, I want to turn to you on this. As you listen to Chris Murphy over the course of the last few days, and then Richard Blumenthal, who we'll hear from in just a moment on our show yesterday, are you hearing anything specific from Connecticut's delegation, especially from the senators here, that is surprising to you? They seem to be essentially saying to President Obama, you got to prove to us that this is a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a better world if more things were debated this way. I mean, this is an issue that's not being debated along party lines. Leadership, Republican and Democratic leadership, have lined up with the president on intervention. And then, you know, people are not following. People from each party are making up their own minds, following their own conscience, asking good questions. I'm actually very grateful that Chris Murphy is there asking the questions that he's asking, and that he's not Joe Lieberman, and that he's not Linda McMahon. I think he's sort of the guy, among those three anyway, that I like having there asking what I think are very appropriate questions.
Matt, how about you?
Well, I think this is interesting how it could play out. You could see this go down to defeat with a coalition of people like Murphy on the left who are asking tough questions, Tea Party people who want isolationism, and people who are up for reelection who see this as a safer vote to vote no after what happened to politicians who supported the Iraq War.
Yeah. And of course, one of the things to really pay attention to is that with Barack Obama on the way out as a lame duck president, it just seems as though people in his own party don't feel any particular need to do anything other than vote their conscience, do something that's going to work for them.
Oh, that's right. And I think that this is going to be viewed different in the context of history, in that the president did a significant thing here in going to Congress instead of just acting on his own, which the past few presidents have done. So this could set precedent for the decades to come.
I want to welcome into our conversation Mohamed El-Fayoumi, who is a Yale World Fellow and a consul political officer for the Embassy of Egypt in Damascus. We've spoken with people from the Yale World Fellow program in the past, and Mohamed is in New Haven now, joins us by phone. Thank you for joining us, sir, on Where We Live.
Thank you. Hi.
So I'm wondering, first of all, if you can give us your reaction to the president's statement on Saturday and some of what you've been hearing from people like Chris Murphy, Richard Blumenthal, and others in the Connecticut delegation over the course of the last couple of days about possible U.S. military intervention in Syria.
Well, actually, the presidential declaration did not come as a surprise for anybody who was following the Syrian crisis over the past few months. The U.S. felt the need to do something, especially after the alleged use of chemical weapons by the forces of Assad last August, which then and again proved that the Assad is crossing the supposedly red line stated by President Obama. But I have to say that this didn't come as a surprise seeing it from another angle, that the U.S., I have to say bluntly, the U.S. is actually not very well knowledgeable of what it has to do, because I mean, there has been a crisis for 30 months now. More than 100,000 of people died, and almost 3 million of people who left the country. And now the U.S. is thinking whether or not Assad used weapons of mass destruction. So I'm not sure what mass destruction means if 100,000 people have been killed is not mass enough. So,
and you seem to be saying something that we've heard from a number of people we've spoken to who spend time in that region, that for many people there, they don't see the difference between 100,000 people dying by bullets fired from guns and from mortar rounds and a chemical attack. In your mind, is there no real difference? Because the president, John Kerry, seems to think there is a big difference.
Well, actually, maybe there is a difference for the U.S. Maybe there is a difference for the strategic norms that have to be enforced. But there is no difference for Syrian people who die every day. I mean, so if a Syrian father finds his kid died, who was killed by a bullet or by a missile or by a barrel of TNT, it doesn't matter, and it doesn't make a big difference then if it is by sarin gas or by any kind of chemical weapons. So the point is the U.S. actually determined on stopping the killing, or it is just acting according to or to its own agenda, which is like saving the president's face, restoring U.S. credibility, rather than stopping the killing.
Colin, I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit. This idea that Chris Murphy and John Kerry got into in this hearing yesterday, we've heard this tape a few times now. Basically, they're arguing over what the dispute is about. Kerry's saying the dispute is, you know, what are we going to do about this thing that we have to do something about? Murphy, in so many words, saying, do we have to do anything? Are we absolutely sure of that? What, in your mind, Colin, is the dispute about?
Well, and I think our guest has kind of hit the nail on the head here in the sense that this does seem to be a dispute about, A, the fact that President Obama used that term red line, and once you use the term red line, then you kind of have to enforce it. It seems to be, B, also about kind of a larger field of action, a sense that other countries are watching. What happens when we say we would do A if you do B, and then we don't do A? And to me, I can understand that better than I can understand a lot of the posturing right now. I don't understand this shot across the bow approach to military action. I don't get it. It's like wrapping a dog on the snout with a rolled up newspaper. Either you're serious enough about this to really take down some of Assad's military capacity, or begin a process of regime change or something. Or I don't understand what you're doing. I don't really understand the purpose of this military exercise. I guess I'm with Chris Murphy on that.
And Mohammed, one thing that Chris Murphy said the other day that kind of resonated with me. He asked the question: we wonder whether there is a limit to the ability of American military power to influence the politics on the ground of the Middle East. This is another one of the big questions here. No matter what the U.S. decides to do, what he's essentially asking is, have we learned a lesson over the course of the last 20 years or so? Maybe there's nothing we can do to influence politics in the Middle East at all.
Well, I'm not sure about this. I mean, if the U.S. perceives itself and the world perceive the U.S. as a major power and a major player in the whole world, and the Middle East especially, and particularly perceive the U.S. as the major player in our region, then the U.S. has a lot to do. Maybe the U.S. has to just have to come out with a strategy, not just like tactical or time-limited steps. It has to come with a strategy. It has to really define what its interests are in the region. Then they have to act accordingly. But the U.S. has a lot of leverage on all sides in the region if they decide to actually use it. Let's say, for example, in the situation we are in, the crisis in Syria over the past 30 months, we have different players. One of them on one side, it is the Gulf countries who are actually back and support and finance many of the opposition groups on the ground. And it goes without saying the kind of relationship the U.S. has with these countries. On the other hand, we have Turkey, which is also a major player, and it's a NATO member in the NATO, and the U.S. has a lot of leverage over Turkey. On the other side, on the totally other side, we have Russia and we have Iran. Yes, maybe the U.S. doesn't have much leverage on those two countries in particular, but there is something in diplomacy and in international politics which is called negotiations. And I actually didn't see the U.S. going to negotiations on the Syrian crisis after tens of thousands of people killed with either Russia or Iran.
We're talking with Mohammed El-Thayoumi, who is a Yale World Fellow, also a political officer for the Embassy of Egypt in Damascus. He's joining us in the wheelhouse today with Colin McEnroe and Matt DiRenzo. We're going to take some of your phone calls, too, at 860-275-7266. Let's go to Ed in West Hartford. Hello, Ed. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Okay. I'd just like to comment that, you know, I'm old enough to have observed the other wars that the U.S. has recently engaged in Afghanistan and Iraq. From the very beginning, I can recall all of the dissimulations that have been later proven to have been the basis for these wars to be launched, and I'm seeing that over again, although the circumstances in each country are different. And it's very sad and angering to see that in the wake of these wars, that Obama, who was voted in by many progressives thinking they were going to get a peace president, is basically being pushed from behind to do more interventions than George Bush ever had any opportunity to. And it's a debacle. And if this war is launched, there's no telling where it's going to go.
Ed, thank you very much for that. And Matt DiRenzo, you know, one thing to sort of take a look at here, not just in Connecticut, but all across the nation, political opinion amongst the people. It doesn't seem as though America has a great desire to get into any sort of military action right now. How much do you think, whether it's President Obama or any of our elected officials, are going to be paying attention to people like Ed who just called?
Oh, I think they will be, and I think that public opinion probably is against this. That's why I think it's important to bring back this issue of chemical weapons. I don't think this is about getting involved in a regime change in Syria or trying to influence Mideast policy or the appetite of anybody to want to get into the affairs of a country, no matter how many people have died. I think it's about drawing a line in the sand to say that chemical weapons is a taboo that we don't want to cross. It's not a weapon we want established for future conflicts. And so that we have to make a big statement about that. And I think if the debate needs to be framed that way for people to understand it better.
I want to just play something that Richard Blumenthal said on our program yesterday when we had in the senator. He was talking about this strategy, what he's hoping for, a little bit more of a wider ranging strategy that Mohammed was talking about a moment ago. Let's listen.
The president's case is compelling in viewing what Assad has done, but we have to consider the wider risks and ramifications.
Essentially, he's saying, Matt DiRenzo, the president's making this case pretty well about chemical weapons. It's just he hasn't made the case for any of the other stuff that may or may not happen.
Right. And I don't think people are buying into the rest either.
I want to bring into the conversation Adib Chouiki, who's a Syrian national and also a West Haven businessman who's working at the Sawasia Charity Foundation. He's joined us in the program before to talk about his home country. And Adib, welcome back to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. First of all, I'm wondering if you can give me your reaction to what's been going on in Washington the last couple of days and what you're hearing from people in Syria about possible U.S. intervention here.
Well, obviously, we've been closely watching what's going on. I listened to the hearing yesterday. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee would be meeting senators and congressmen all over. I was very encouraged with the statement, the opening statement of Mr. Kerry. One thing we have to bear in mind, I understand the American people, they don't have an appetite for war. Over here in Syria, it's totally different. Everybody's been comparing the situation in Syria or the possible attack of the Americans to Syria, just like Iraq or Afghanistan. It's totally different. The situation in Syria, it's been going on for 2.5 years, killing day by day. And on the 21st of August, I think it tipped the balance. So we're talking on the moral issue. Morally, the United States, has the obligation to intervene. And why the United States? From national interest for the United States, the situation in Syria and the Assad being there, we know we have chemical weapons. We know from more than one source and from our lab test here in the United States for fragments and hair samples came from the town which was hit, that it did happen. We have satellite image that those missiles came out of from the government-controlled area to the other side. So I think that gives us a situation that he has chemical weapons. He can use it. He has very strong relation with Hezbollah. So the case should be to the American people and to the Congress that in case if this guy stayed as is and he stayed in power, that's going to have a huge threat to the neighboring countries, whether Israel or Iraq or even the Gulf region. Those weapons might be smuggled in there, and then we have to deal with it. So I think it's the proper time to do it now.
Well, I want Colin, jump in.
And one question I think that a lot of people in America have about this is, why would Assad use chemical weapons in a situation like this? He's not militarily losing. He knows that there's a very potential trigger here. He knows about the red line. So he knows that something we would think he would find undesirable will happen if he uses the weapons. I think a lot of Americans are asking, are you really sure these came from Assad? Because it seems so counterproductive for him to use chemical weapons at this moment.
Adib, you want a quick comment?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, over here, we learned our lesson from the Iraqi war. Iraqi war was built on false and misleading information. Over here, it doesn't make sense for the Free Syrian Army or the opposition to kill their own people in their own territory. The Ghouta, the Zamalka or Arbin or Hamouria or those towns, small towns, which is like 5 miles from where I used to live, those are very much liberated land. So why should I do that as an opposition to bomb my own kids and my own children? And the satellite image, it's just so clear. Obviously, you know, in opposition, nobody can discuss that. But it was so clear where it came from. It came from the Qassoun. It came from the fourth brigade, which is basically around the main highway, the western side of Damascus to the east side of Damascus. So. I mean, it just logically it doesn't make sense for the opposition to kill their own kids
and in the morning. And let me just jump in. I'll ask you a question, Colin. On the flip side of this, given what happened with the run-up to war in Iraq, it would seem as though the Obama administration would take every single pain possible to make absolutely sure that what Adib Twiki is saying is absolutely true, that as much as it might not make sense for Bashar Assad to gas his own people, it really doesn't make sense for John Kerry to sit up there and say, we know this happened, trust us, if it didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just heard a better and a more clearly articulated argument on behalf of this from our guest than the American public has heard from its leadership. I mean, this really is a situation post-Iraq, post-Colin Powell. This is a situation where probably President Obama himself has to go before the American public and kind of the way, to use a spurious example, kind of the way Ronald Reagan would explain, you know, why Nicaragua was important. But using visual aids and clear argument, he's really got to say, this is what happened. This is how we know what happened. This is why we want to do this. This is why we feel we have to do this. And I don't think the American public has heard that kind of argument, that kind of clear and illustrated argument that it needs to hear. And I think that's why support for this is so soft.
I'll just say at this hour, President Obama has been making some remarks. Our friend Jolynn Kent, who now works at Fox News, just tweeted that Obama said, my credibility is not on the line. The international community's credibility is on the line. I'll put that to Mohammed El-Fayoumi, who's joining us on the phone, Yale World Fellow. Talk about that, about the rest of the world's involvement in this. It seems as though, Mohammed, that a lot of people, including the Brits, have left the U.S. behind here. Is this an international problem to solve, or is this a U.S. problem to solve?
Well, actually, coming from the region, we have like low faith in that this thing called the international community actually exists, because for several years now atrocities have been made, whether in Syria and, I have to say it, on Palestine and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict over like 60 years now, and still no show for the international community if they actually solve this. But coming back to Syria, this is an international problem. This is a problem, a crisis that is actually the international security, international norms, and everything, international humanity and civilization, is at stake here. We are in 2013, and 100,000 people dying on the hands of like brutal forces is not something to be just let go or to forget about. There is something Please. Here that has to be made clear. The question should not be, should we strike, should the U.S. strike or not strike? The question should be whether the U.S. has a strategy, whether this strike is one step in a number of steps that cover the whole thing, that will end this conflict that will stop the bloodshed in Syria, or will it just be something, a tactical move for domestic reasons? This is how we want to see it. This is me, myself, as somebody who lived in Syria for 4 years and living in a neighboring country, which is Egypt, and Syria is of strategic importance to us. Then we have to know, is this part of a strategy or just a tactical move for domestic reasons?
Well, and you bring up the fact that you are from Egypt. Maybe you can speak about that for a moment. Of course, Egypt is in its own political turmoil. There was a democratic election that was essentially overturned. There have been people getting killed in the streets. There has been unrest there, and it is clearly a very strategically important place, just like Syria is in the region. Mohammed, it seems as though the United States has one way of dealing with Egypt and another way of dealing with Syria, and that's probably pretty clear to the people in the region, isn't it?
Well, Egypt is a totally different case, and the situation in Egypt is totally different. We have, historically different, demographically different, the components of the society, and the whole process is totally different. But so it needs different treatment. But I have to admit that, I have to say it as well, that the U.S. is not very well informed about the situation in Egypt, and they still have these back and forth decisions and statements that they are talking, that they are taking towards the situation in Egypt. It requires a lengthy discussion about the situation in Egypt now, so I believe it would be better to just focus on Syria for the time being.
And we will for the next few minutes. Adib Chouiki, one of the things I want to ask you about is, what do you think the U.S. goal should be here? When you've made a very passionate case for the fact that these chemical weapons were launched by the Assad regime and the U.S. should do something about it, but what should they be trying to do? Should they be pushing for regime change in Syria? Should they be aiding the rebels in that fight? Where do they stop exactly?
I'm glad you asked this question. In fact, I was trying to speak about it. Now, one thing, the United States and the Syrian people, we are not looking for full invasion of the country. We definitely don't want no American boots. As an American, as a Syrian, I don't want no American boots on the ground. Now, what should be the objective of this attack or possible attack? What we need, we don't need cosmetic bombing for the Syrian regime. What we need is strategic to bomb his, the military facility, the airfield, so he will not be able to fly or to deliver any future chemical attack. I was speaking to the people inside Kafr Batna, which is next to the Malka, the city where it had 7 of those missiles on that day. They've been telling me, I have picture came from Daraya 2 days ago with kids carrying signs to the congressman, please vote yes. Starting war or bombing Syria, it's to end the war, it's not to start war. So what I'm hoping from the United States, and I'm kind of encouraged with the last statement, even change of the language with the Senator, with the Mr. Kerry, that the objective is going to be to hit the strategic areas, military areas in Damascus and the other cities surrounding, and at the same time provide the right weapons for the Free Syrian Army, which is a moderate Free Syrian Army, which Mr. McCain has been meeting more than once with, to give them the weapons to be able to finish the job. It's not a proxy war. What we're doing is trying to weaken the regime from attacking the civilians, and at the same time try to provide the right weapons for the Free Syrian Army to be able to finish the job. And believe me, it's essential for the United States to act now, and I was kind of disappointed. It was a week, until the Congress come back, but we are in this situation now, and I'm very encouraged. We'll be working with Senator Murphy. I met him more than once, and with Mr. Blumenthal. I'm hoping they will vote yes for this.
Adib Chouiki is a Syrian, and he's a businessman in West Haven. He's working with the Sawasia Charity Foundation. He's joined us in the program before, and Adib, we will check in with you again as we watch the situation. Thank you so much for your time. I truly appreciate it. Thank you also to Mohammed El-Fayoumi, who is a Yale World Fellow and is a consul political officer for the Embassy of Egypt in Damascus. Mohammed, I'd like to check in with you again as we watch this situation as well. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Now, when we come back, we're going to go from the very global issue of potential war with Syria to the very, very local. There are municipal elections happening very soon in several Connecticut communities, and we want to hear from you about them at 860-275-7266. We're in the wheelhouse here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, and we're moving from the most global issue to the most local. Next Tuesday is primary day for municipal races in 21 towns. You can call us to tell us about the race that you're watching, 860-275-7266. And we're going to go through a series of them right now. But first, I want to bring in Colin to just talk a little bit about this. With 21 primaries, it seems as though people want to get involved in town politics, Colin, for some strange reason. Is this encouraging to you?
Well, it's both encouraging. I think it would be wrong to draw too much from this. And in fact, you know, participation in local primaries and local elections tends to be kind of low. And you know, Julie Lewin just did this study of margins, in which the margins also are very close. So if you want to have – are often very close. There are like 1%, 2% wins in a lot of these towns in the general election. So if you want to have an impact, if you want your political participation to be meaningful, it's a great thing to do, to get interested in town politics. But I think what happens is that passions burn brightly among a smaller group. I'm not sure that they take the rest of the town along with them.
Well, passions burn brightly. And I'll just say, for as much time as we spend here in The Wheelhouse or on Where We Live talking about state politics, it is interesting that we're doing this today where we're talking about something where passions burn brightly, about war, about potential U.S. military intervention, and also about local town politics. The fact of the matter is that a lot of the things we debate, Matt DiRenzo, at the state level may or may not impact our lives, but we truly care whether or not we send people off to war, and we truly care who's going to fix our potholes.
Syria puts the local leaf blower ordinance in perspective.
It does indeed. Let's go to Paul Bass, who's editor of the New Haven Independent, to join us to talk about two important races that he's looking at. Of course, the city of New Haven, which you've been following for some time. Good to hear from you, Paul.
Good. How you doing, guys? We're very excited about the New Haven mayor race, very consumed with it, but it is daunting to listen to a conversation about Syria and the life or death questions there and the geopolitics, and then try to narrow back down to earth here in New Haven. It's a different magnitude.
Well, yeah, we talked about that a little bit on the program last week, that amongst the things Chris Murphy's been doing is making an endorsement in the New Haven mayor's primary and then also taking on John Kerry in Washington. But first of all, Paul, because I have Matt DiRenzo here, I want to get your take first, Paul, on what we should make of the New Haven Register's endorsement of Henry Fernandez in this race. Were you surprised by this at all?
No, because the Register, which paper I love, great reporters, they've been an advocacy vehicle for the Fernandez campaign and against the Harp campaign, Tony Harp campaign, since the campaign began, which I say that with respect, I promise, because in my I used to work in an advocacy newspaper, and it's good, it's a noble profession. The campaign's a pretty complicated campaign. It's an interesting display of four different approaches to politics and how you make change in a city and how you run a city. And Fernandez has one of very four distinct approaches, and it's been a great choice for the city.
Matt, why'd you make this endorsement?
Well, I'd respectfully disagree that we've been advocating in our reporting for Henry Fernandez with my friend Paul. but I think that Tony Harp has given reporters a lot of material to work with in terms of some of the stuff to write about. But, you know, Fernandez outlined this vision of putting more cranes in the sky over the New Haven skyline, and economic development has the track record to back that up. And we did not see that from other candidates. Justin Ellerker has many great ideas, a brilliant guy, and probably the first interview in a long time I can remember where a politician answered every single one of our questions head on without dodging it, even the questions that are kind of like gotcha that they can't win by answering, you know, he answered, which was really, really impressive. But, you know, Tony Harp came into our editorial board meeting, which was pretty extensive, and you just got the impression that she was running because she could be coronated and that it was hers to take, and that there was just no vision or plan there to move the city forward in a way that would lift the middle class up or put more people into the middle class, which Fernandez has just a very specific plan for. And that's what led to our decision.
But Paul Bass, on the ground, what are you hearing from people in New Haven? I mean, do they necessarily want more cranes in the sky? Is that what the folks in New Haven are looking for?
Well, cranes in the sky are a great idea. You need six major big development projects a year to get enough tax revenue to avoid a one-mill tax increase. So cranes in the sky are a great idea. You're not going to have six projects a year that are like 300 George Street. The city's much more complicated than that. What I'm hearing from New Haven is it's a very divided city. We're going to have a series of maps. They show where the financial support is for the candidates. So it's almost like Bantustans in South Africa. So you got Justin Elker has this intense support among pockets of some of the white middle-class neighborhoods. Kermit Carolina is running a campaign that's completely focused on getting young black males and other young African-Americans who have never been involved in the process out to vote, the hardest people to get, but the only way he can get elected. Harp comes from a tradition. You know, if you just walk into a campaign in a city and you've never met these people for or followed them for the last 25 years, it might look like one has a plan or one is a tracker and the others don't. Harp has a Harp is the most popular politician in New Haven. She was the only one who used to beat John DeStefano, the incumbent mayor, in popularity polls, and she could have won for mayor. So I think Matt's right that there was this idea. It was kind of handed to her when she wasn't planning to run because a group in town wanted to win. But she has a deep record of accomplishment and knowledge about issues that has not come out on the campaign trail because she's been a woefully weak candidate on the campaign trail in terms of presenting her ideas. I mean, last weekend's debate was embarrassing to see an experienced politician spend an entire debate on TV not saying once why you should vote for her, not mentioning that she is the number one legislator in the General Assembly going over every line of a $40 billion budget every 2 years. And she actually came off in debate as someone who's never done budgeting. And it looked like Fernandez and Elker, who's been here 6 years, have done more budgets in their life than she ever did. But there's this deep reservoir of popularity for Harp that's enhanced by the Yale unions, who are the biggest political force in town, who are working to get her elected as part of a New Haven workforce agenda. Fernandez was a very successful city official. He's a strong, competent leader. He comes out of the tradition of Mayor John DeStefano, which is sort of like every 2 years you have democracy. You elect somebody and see if they're doing a good job, and they come in and they just kind of break bones and get it done. And there's a strong feeling that that's what can move the city forward. The interesting thing, there's no sense of history in this debate. Henry Fernandez was very allied with Mayor DeStefano up to the last election 2 years ago when he worked very hard for him, ran his governor campaign in 2006. And now he's the one on his flyers presenting a picture of a city that's in crisis, that has terrible schools, that has had rampant financial mismanagement for two decades, and he has to vote for him to fix it. And this is never getting pointed out, which is kind of odd. Elker has run the best campaign in town. He had the least to work with because he's been here only 6 years, been in public office 3 years. He's done great on the stump one-on-one and appealing to the newer part of New Haven, the people who have chickens in their yards or ride their bikes to work or work for NGOs because they don't trust party machines or bureaucracy.
And you have a really interesting piece in the New Haven Independent today about Justin Elker trying to make his case to a series of Yale professors, which is an interesting read by Melissa Bailey. Colin, I just want to give you a couple seconds to wrap up New Haven here because we've got to move on to the next town next door.
Just a quick question for Paul, and there may be no quick answer to this, but one of the possibilities is that that Fernandez and Harper are going to come out of this running 1-2 somehow. We don't know which order in the primary. And then as we go towards November, Paul, is there any possibility that Elker and Carolina get out and start backing somebody? I would assume.
Well, the election were last week. It was going to be Harp Elker. Mm-hmm. Elker ran way ahead of Fernandez. Fernandez got a lot of momentum in the last week because the resident endorsement, because he did very well in that debate where Harp did badly. But it's two elections next Tuesday, Colin. It's Harp versus Carolina for the black vote, and it's Elker versus Fernandez for the white vote and for second place. And Fernandez is using targeted direct mail to distinguish from Elker in Westville and East Rock, the two key neighborhoods. So if Harp gets over 50% in the primary, she's in a strong position. The other three candidates are running in both elections, the primary and the general.
And there's no possibility that they'll drop out, or that maybe DeStefano, who stayed out of this for a long, which is amazing.
I think people will drop out, Colin. Yeah. And I think what we're probably going to see is either a Harp Elker or a Harp Fernandez general election.
Well, we'll be watching very closely. You can read all about it, the New Haven Independent. Paul Bass is always the editor and founder of the Independent. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, John.
Hey, now, we're going to turn to the town next door. East Haven is always just fascinating to watch, Matt DiRenzo. Of course, the incumbent Republican, Joe Maturo, has made some insensitive comments over the years. And there's a little bit of a race for who's going to challenge him.
Well, insensitive comments doubled with a very real and serious issue there where the Department of Justice has, by consent decree, oversight of the police department for racial profiling of Latino residents. I think that this, out of any other primary on Tuesday, is the most important election in Connecticut. And there's the most at stake and the starkest difference between two Democratic candidates. You have Jack Stacey, a social studies teacher with very little experience, political experience, running against Gary DePalma. Gary DePalma is a recently retired member of that same police department. And in sitting down with us in an extensive interview, he said that he does not believe that there was any issues with the police department and that it was four rogue police officers that created this whole problem, and he's not even sure if they're guilty or not, that a trial will show that out.
It doesn't seem as though the Justice Department would agree.
No, they don't. And so he has a legitimate shot of winning this primary on Tuesday, in my opinion. And that would set up East Haven with an election between Joe Maturo as possibly the more progressive candidate on this issue of the police department and the Justice Department, which would be, you know, if that happens, it would be a big statement from the community of East Haven that they reject this whole notion that it's wrong to
But there has been a sense, and you cover the community closely, yeah. There has been a sense that many in that community do reject this notion. They have rejected this notion time that there's something wrong. And so you're saying it would not be a terrible surprise if indeed this is what we saw. Two people who are essentially falling on the same side of this spectrum here, a Republican and a Democrat, ending up in November in a race.
It wouldn't be a terrible surprise. It would be a big setback for the ability to move forward.
You know, I think this campaign, at least from a distance, is a very odd one in the sense that Gary DePalma, he's the retired policeman, has said almost nothing about what he believes. I mean, people in East – if there's information being disseminated, it's at a dog whistle level. And I think people in New Haven are frustrated about this, that they really have almost no idea what this guy believes. And he doesn't want to have any debates because then people will find out what he believes. And I think it makes for a very confusing primary. If they vote for Gary DePalma, they'll either do it because, they, once again, at a dog whistle level, they think they know what he believes, or they just like the idea that he's a 25-year police veteran. But whereas Stacey has kind of staked out kind of what you would think would be the Democratic position on all this, and a reform position, and a let's have this be a town that where when your wife wants to host some people and a couple of them are minorities, they're not afraid to come to dinner at your house. You know, and I think if he doesn't win the primary, the Democrats in town will feel as though that line on their ballot kind of got hijacked by this guy wearing a mask.
Matt, quickly?
Yeah, well, yes, he's refused. DePalma has refused to debate us. In our meeting, he had another cop with him who answered half the questions we asked him. It was a bizarre situation.
That's a very bizarre situation. Before we take a break, we're taking some phone calls at 860-275-7266 as we talk about municipal elections. Steven's in Middletown. Hey, Steven.
Hi, John.
Hi, what's up?
My name's Stephen DeVoto, and I'm a candidate for planning and zoning in the primary on the Democratic side in Middletown. And it's great to have some focus from your show on the primaries. There are four candidates running, and I was a petitioning candidate running against the three town-endorsed candidates for planning and zoning.
Have you ever done this before, Stephen?
I have not. I've been very interested in land use decisions because I think they are some of the most important decisions that a city can make. I've been taking time to educate myself about planning and zoning and inland wetlands and so on. For the last 5 years, I've gone to most of the planning and zoning meetings. I decided to run because I felt that the Planning and Zoning Commission could do much more for the city.
Well, Stephen, thank you very much for the phone call. Matt Dorenza, do you have any insight into this race in Middletown? You probably do, right?
This is very interesting, getting back to your initial question to Colin. So Middletown has a Democratic primary on Tuesday. The only thing on the ballot is Planning and Zoning Commission. What do you think the turnout will be, 4%, 3%?
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting—
Yeah, yeah, if you are running for Planning and Zoning in Middletown or if you plan to vote in that election, yeah, maybe the same numbers, you can call us right now at 860-275-7266. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about a few other towns. Torrington, out in my neck of the woods. Also, we'll be hearing from Norwich and Killingworth. Some important, interesting races. If you want to call us and let us know about the primary that you're watching in your town, 860-275-7266 as we take a look at the week's news in the Wheelhouse here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're doing a show that, well, frankly, should probably be on the Colin McEnroe Show. Ever been caught doodling at work or in class?
That should be on our show.
It really should. If you've been told doodling is a sign you're distracted, a study actually shows that this may not be the case. Doodling can be a way to focus, absorb information, and channel extra energy. We will be talking about the power of doodling on tomorrow's Where We Live. I know you're upset about this, Colin. This could have been your show.
Yeah, we're doing a show about Syria, so there.
Colin McEnroe is the host of WNPR's The Colin McEnroe Show. He joins us in the wheelhouse today, as does Matt DiRenzo, who's group editor for the 21st Century Media Company, a number of newspapers, including the New Haven Register and the Torrington Register Citizen. We'll be talking about Torrington in just a moment. But as we talk about municipal elections here in the state, let's go through a few of them and talk with Ray Hackett, who's an opinion writer and editor for the Norwich Bulletin. Hey, Ray, good to talk to you.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Colin. Good morning, Matt. How's everybody today?
I think we're all doing okay. Yeah,
oh,
it's a good morning. So Ray, tell us about the Democratic primary in your town, in Norwich. You just wrote, not exactly the most scintillating race. What's at stake here?
Well, what's at stake is, let me put it in perspective first and foremost, is 12 years ago, Norwich returned to a mayoral form of government. But in doing so, they opted to go with a weak mayor form of government. In other words, the mayor is a member of the city council with no more authority or ability or power than any other member on the council, yet the charter now requires that individual to be responsible for economic development here in the city of Norwich. And basically, there's two truisms that we know in politics. You either stay the course or it's time for a change. Staying the course is not bad if the community is prospering. Here in Norwich, we are not prospering. And we have two candidates, two Democratic aldermen, sitting on the council right now who will be competing next week. One wants to go back into the charter and change things to bring about a strong mayoral form of government with the powers necessary to act in taking on that challenge of economic development. The other candidate would prefer to maintain the status quo, does not want to open up the charter. Now, charters are very boring issues. I mean, you're not going to attract a lot of people out on the street waving signs when you're talking about, you know, changing the language in the city charter, and that's where we really are. So it's a critical vote in the sense that the incumbent is running, Republican Peter Nystrom. There's a Libertarian in the race, so it's going to be a three-way contest in November. But right now, the Democrats are having a hard time getting any interest developing here. The caucus gave the nomination to Charlie Jaskiewicz 35-34 over Deb Hinchey.
So this is very tight within the Democrats. Colin?
You know, Ray, to an outsider's eyes, it seems like there's more at stake in terms of charter review than simply strong mayor, weak mayor. And Norwich's form of government looks, once again, to an outsider, a little eccentric. For example, the city council apparently is the zoning board, which seems to promise very long meetings about not very big issues. And the Economic Development Agency isn't even really a kind of a quasi-public. It's sort of like a quasi-private or something, or a quasi-nonprofit. I mean, in talking about charter reform, I assume they are talking about more than just whether it's strong mayor, weak mayor, but like maybe getting all this stuff streamlined a little bit.
Well, that's what the Charlie Jaskiewicz, who favors a charter revision, he's bringing up those issues. He does believe that there should be a separation between the city council and the zoning board. And he also wants to, you know, rework the definition of economic development responsibility and put more power into the hands of the mayor to utilize the quasi-public agency, the Norwich Community Development Authority right now, who actually reports to a separate, independent, self-appointed board of directors. So, yeah, it does get a little bizarre around here.
You can see Colin's face right now. Ray Hackett, of course, opinion columnist for the Norwich Bulletin. We'll be reading you, Ray, to find out what's going on in your town. Thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime.
They're in a narco-syndicalist collective or something.
I want to bring in Peg Schofield, who's the editor of Killingworth Today, covering the town of Killingworth. And Peg, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, John.
So now the intrigue in Killingworth is on the Republican side. What's at stake on Tuesday here?
Well, incumbents in November are I think, more worried because we worry about 500 people coming out to vote, and so a swing one way or the other can make a difference. But I think the Republican Town Committee and the Killingworth Conservatives, which are fighting it out next week, are not coming from a position of strength. And I think the costs involved and the sideshow effect is the most interesting thing to look at.
Well, we just heard from Ray Hackett about the big issues that are at stake. I mean, what are the big things happening right now in Killingworth that everyone's going to be fighting over on Tuesday and also in November?
Well, the issues are always taxes, emergency preparedness. We have a town hall renovation that seems to be a topic of conversation, a fire tower. But we don't, you know, we have a very small government. We have a $4.5 million budget, and we have a fairly balanced voter base. And our, you know, 10 to 12% turnout for municipal elections doesn't give you a lot of real high energy topics.
So a 10 to 12% turnout in a very small town like that, Colin, that's what we were talking about before.
Yeah, and you just sort of highlight the Killington Conservative, which is this sort of new sort of—
Killingworth.
Yes, Killingworth.
Sorry about that. Killingworth Conservative, which is, you know, kind of this fragment party from the Republican Party, which is a little bit different. One of the things we are seeing in Connecticut towns are the rise of these independent parties that are specific to the town. So in Willington, you've got the Sentinel Party, which is kind of a creepy Stephen King name, but they actually seem pretty nice. You've got the Trolley Party in East Haven. We didn't talk about the Trolley Party, Matt. You've got the Chatham Party in East Hampton. This seems a little different. This seems like a splinter group away from the Republican Party. The one thing that I would caution the people of Killingworth is that they should read before the election Longfellow's poem, The Birds of Killingworth, because it's actually about town government and about what happens when you make rash, short-sighted decisions. I don't know what that would be in Killingworth in this day and age, but you should definitely not. You shouldn't kill all the birds anyway, is what I'm telling you.
The Birds of Killingworth, very good. Peg Schofield will be watching. Peg Schofield is editor of Killingworth Today, the paper that covers the town of Killingworth. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Now, we want to end here with Matt DiRenzo. We just have a few minutes left, and Torrington is in the news. The mayor, Ryan Bingham, announced earlier just this year, just a little bit ago, that he's not seeking re-election. So what's happening now in this primary?
Right. So he's been mayor for 8 years. He was elected at 22. He's having a—
he was elected at the age of 12, near as we can tell you.
He says, I'm 30. My wife's about to have a baby. Half my life has been mayor. So, you know, he's stepping down.
Half my life has been mayor.
So Eleanor Carbone is unopposed as a Republican, big name in Torrington, city councilor, very popular, the favorite in November for sure. And two unknowns, 23-year-old Colin Good and a realtor named George Craig, are running for the Democratic primary. We expect very, very low turnout. We're hosting a debate on Saturday so that people know who the heck these people are and what they—
And what's the big issue? I mean, in Torrington, I mean, what are they going to be fighting over?
Well, Ryan Bingham's legacy is holding the line on taxes, but it's a very high tax rate to begin with because of the low tax base. And so I think you'll see the issue of taking bigger risks to try to spur economic development, spending a little bit of money to try to leverage something. So it's a kind of a classic Republican versus Democrat debate.
We just have a little bit of time left. Julie Lewin, who you mentioned before, Colin, is calling us from Guilford. Hi, Julie.
Hi there, John.
Hi. Well, what's on your mind?
Yes, I've just completed a study. In fact, I just began sending it out yesterday on voter turnout in Connecticut's municipal elections. I've analyzed so far 51 cities and towns, election by election, you know, district by district, and nearly all the towns that have been discussed today. And I've just looked up Norwich in my study, and the, you know, voter turnout has been mentioned. But what it translates is that, like, this tiny percentage of voting eligible people determine elections, and that means that that gives a great potential to any issue group, any nonpartisan issue group, or even a partisan issue group, to organize and get out the vote and register people. I mean, the percentages are like fractions of 1%.
Well, and we saw that. Julie, thank you very much, because we're running low on time. Thank you for that, and we'll be looking more into that study. Colin, we saw a little bit of this the last time around. Sometimes this big national money or even statewide money gets into these local races. Julie says it can make a difference, perhaps.
Yeah, you don't have to change a lot of votes to win one of these races. I was doodling while she was talking.
Oh, you were doodling. Yeah. It helps to stimulate brain power. Right. You can find out more, actually, on Tomorrow's Where We Live. I want to thank Colin McEnroe, who is the host of the Colin McEnroe Show. What's coming up this afternoon, Colin, on the show?
This afternoon on the show, you would ask, Michael Bolton. We have an interview with Michael Bolton.
Of course you do.
A doodle-free interview with Michael Bolton.
Matt DiRenzo is group editor for the 21st Century Media Company. Thank you very much, Matt,
for
your time. And thank you to everyone who called us. Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives with Betsy Kaplan and Heather Brandon. The senior producer is Katie Schlarsky. Thank you to the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network, for joining us for today's Wheelhouse on Where We Live.